simply keeping things the way they are, trying to preserve like a dead system isn't enough.
Hi, I'm Andrew Goldstein, and this is The Art Angle, a podcast from ArtNet News where the art world meets the real world, bringing each week's biggest story down to earth. On Memorial Day, in the midst of a pandemic that has disproportionately killed African Americans, America's black community was dealt another blow with the murder of George Floyd at the hands of the Minneapolis police. After too many such killings over too many years, it proved to be a blow too many. Since then, a tidal wave of protests has radiated across the country, uniting people of all backgrounds against the entrenched forces of systemic racial injustice and unending police brutality. I can't imagine anyone being unmoved by the events unfolding these days. And as ArtNet News' Noor Brower found out, there were plenty of artists on the front lines as the protests took shape over the weekend. She wrote an amazing piece about it, which you should read. And to talk about it, I'm glad to have here on the podcast. So thanks very much for coming back on The Art Angle, Noor.
Thanks for having me, Andrew.
Friday night, after a long week of coronavirus coverage, as your weekend was just getting started, you slacked Julia Halperin, the executive editor over here, to say that there was a story that you felt was very urgent to be done. What was the idea and how did this come to you?
I had a friend of mine, I saw her posting about the protests that were happening down at Barclays Center in Brooklyn on Instagram. And it's not easy really for me to get to. I live all the way uptown, but I saw that so many people were going, despite the fact that we were in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic, where most people hadn't been around more than a couple people, let alone the crowd of thousands and thousands of people. But at that moment, I felt that I had to engage with what was happening. The protests were to honor George Floyd and protest his violent death at the hands of police. And I had sort of been putting off watching the video of his death. And so I decided to watch it. And I found it harrowing. I found it horrible. I really felt that I needed to do something about it. And I kind of had this sense that many artists not only were at that protest, but would continue to protest throughout the weekend. And I thought that it was just a moment of history that we needed to kind of capture through their perspective.
I think a lot of people across the country were shocked by what happened to George Floyd. And it really seemed to break through the kind of more abstract ideas of inequality and racism in America. It was such a flashpoint of pure and unadulterated brutality that everybody was taking action of some kind. Why was it that you wanted to focus on what artists were doing?
You know, put simply, I think the stories of artists are unique and they have really amazing insights into the human condition. They really feel things deeply and profoundly, and they pick up on glimmers of things and nuances in our day-to-day life that they explore within their practices. And those are the things that often escape other people, and I think that's why they turn to art, to kind of engage with those struggles, the larger universal emotions that we all feel. I knew that their testimonies in particular, their sort of tellings of what they saw on the ground would be particularly poignant. And just in the way that we all turn to art to connect communities and people from disparate cultures all the time, I was hoping that their stories would find a way to kind of bring people more closely together. A lot of the artists also engage really meaningfully in these discussions in their everyday work and practices. And I really felt that all of that sort of knowledge that they had accumulated about these issues would provide tremendous context.
And so ultimately, you spoke to 18 artists. How did you reach them?
Right. It was a lot of Instagram DMing and emailing people at the suggestion of friends and some of my colleagues. I asked everyone to tell me if they knew an artist or an art world member who was at the protest or who had attended the protests or who was doing something meaningful from behind the scenes, whether that was resource sharing or making artwork. And I was put in touch with this really, really great network of people. And their insights were incredible. Everybody wanted to help everybody wanted to elevate Black voices in the art community and beyond the art community. It was really an incredible group effort in the way that we got all of these stories all together.
Well, they told you some incredibly powerful things. And I think you actually have some recordings from your conversations with them.
Yes, I do. And then I also had a few follow-up conversations with some of the artists who wanted to contribute their voices to our podcast as well. One of the artists that I talked to over the phone is Daryl Wesley. He is a painter from New York. And he had a lot to say about the idea of exhaustion. You know, the Black community is very tired of having to explain their experiences for people who don't kind of innately understand. Here's Daryl talking about that now.
You know, I've been feeling, it's a complex set of emotions to describe, but there's a realization, right, that you sort of, you know, as a Black artist, like, you know, you're dealing with this reality your entire life. Your parents have dealt with it. It's generational, and you're linked together in some way by these tragedies, that there's sort of almost like this connecting thread that every person of color, every Black person essentially is a part of. Every name in a way is like kind of etched into this board that we all carry within our hearts. I mean, there's the immediately kind of sinking feeling of just realizing that this is, you know, that the same scenario is playing again. And then there's this feeling of exhaustion, of this tiredness, of seeing the same thing play out. And one of my friends had put it succinctly, is that to an extent there becomes this frustration even with having to try and explain to the uninitiated what the significance is, what's happening. Like, and I think a lot of those things, it's part of that buildup. It's part of that frustration, part of that, that anger. And, you know, I found myself thinking, like, is that you can't prescribe how anger is vented, how anger manifests. Like,
totally.
There was the frustration of the expectation from people outside of the Black community that, you know, of how people of color, Black people, should be responding to this event. We're looking at the circle of prescription of, like, this is how you should react. And when you are put on the ground and kicked, this is how you should react from being put on the ground and kicked. And I think those are problems. And I think those are things that, so much so that this experience and our understanding of this experience is almost so ingrained that it could be understood as being a habit.
Right.
For those people who don't understand this, who aren't privy to this experience, there needs to be a learning that is, like, systematically taught to the point that the reflex that I believe every person of color has within them in dealing with situations and understanding, like, a person's intent just from simply from a movement of the hand or a gesture of their body, that should exist as a system for learning for how to push forward.
I also talked to Candy Kerr. She is an artist, an embroiderer, and a musician based in Baltimore, who also had some interesting thoughts on this idea of people needing to do the work to understand the struggles of the Black community.
We're just consistently doing work for white people.
Yeah.
They're like, hey, build this country for us. And we're like, do we have to? And they're like, yeah. And then they're like, you know what? Why don't you also tell me all of the ways in which I am doing whiteness, like I am affecting you with my whiteness? And I'm like, I feel like I've already done enough.
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, but if you want me to understand, then you'll educate me.
Yeah.
And I'm like, it's so upsetting that Google doesn't exist. I don't know. Black people we are resilient, but we're also human beings and we're exhausted.
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't know if that's every Black person, but I am resilient, but I'm also human, and so I'm exhausted. Like, that exhaustion means that I'm not interested in peaceful protests. I'm not interested in educating white people. I'm not interested in partnering with white people at this point.
Yeah.
I don't trust my life in the hands of any white person, and that's including the people I know that have done the work. I don't trust myself to be safe beyond, like, some of those people, like, I trust with my life, but, like, beyond those people, I have no trust when it comes to white people. And so I'm done with the trust. I'm done with respectability. I'm done with trying to be a model minority. I'm done with all of the tactics, because none of the tactics work. You know, I'm in a, like, burn it all down space, which is why it's, like, not good for me to go out right now.
Right.
I don't even know if I need to calm down, but until I can be in a space where I am not interested in burning down the entire system and the city with it, then I should not go out.
So another theme in your conversations was that people spoke movingly about the tangled, difficult history that these protests are emerging from.
Right. Another artist that I talked to was Ebony Brown, an artist from Maryland living in New York, who talked about the history of all of this and connected a recent racist incident in Central Park to the Central Park Five from back in the 80s.
You know, we saw that with Amy Cooper, like the irony that that whole situation took place in Central Park was incredible. You know, it made me really see this connection of, like, wow, you know, these five kids were falsely accused and convicted of a brutal rape, and it took years for them to be proven innocent, and their lives were destroyed. And the person that is in the White House took out an ad calling for their execution. And that is the person that is leading our country right now.
Right.
So if that is not frightening, I don't know what is. And I think that that's one of the scariest things about this moment. White people are taught to fear Black people, and they're so deeply afraid of Black people that they are preparing themselves still in 2020 for a slave revolt.
And Daryl Wesley also talked about the kind of boiling up of anger throughout history towards police, because for the Black community, they are symbols of violence. And they showed that by essentially leading with violence amid peaceful protests.
You have this point where you could feel this uneasiness because we're dealing with a history of people being roughly treated, harshly treated by police, especially, like, literally the day before.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, the situation with COVID, where everyone is going and so close together, where we're at one point putting faith in each other as well as putting faith in ourselves that we're going to be safe as we go and do this. And walking down the street, you see, like, we make it over to the bridge and you have these cops go and start brandishing billy clubs in riot gear. And what I do know is that when you're taking this place where people are literally just trying to be heard, and then you're provoking them, actively provoking them by brandishing a weapon in front of them, by putting on armor, donning pepper spray, stepping in front of their path, trying to stop them from being able to walk, or herding them into dangerous situations where people are less than a foot away from each other. Right. You're creating a situation of anger. You're starting a match.
Right.
And I think that what has to be understood is that you're starting a match within people who are already so frustrated and so been kept indoors, and, you know, and that situation, I think, is understanding that you're seeing all the different sides. You're seeing a portrait of America, of people right now. People are scared. People are frustrated. Yeah. People are angry. And they're navigating through these traps. Like, there's these different sides of people, like the fear that's been instilled within the people outside of the parade who are going and watching from the sidelines, the fear that righteous anger that the cops are brandishing against the protesters themselves, that are then causing all of these different infractions to blow up, like, simultaneously.
Right. Well, it seems that the topic of the police was obviously unavoidable in these conversations that you had. And some artists seem to have changed the way that they regard them in the course of these past couple of days. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Yeah. I think one really interesting testimony was from Ebony Brown, who had family members serving in the police force. And she, I think for the first time, had to really contend with the fact that policemen can be bad. She'd always seen the police force as a place of safety.
This was the first time that I went to a rally specifically to protest police brutality.
Right.
And I think that, you know, maybe subconsciously, I've had a false narrative about police that's been running in the back of my mind. And, you know, and it's because I've always grown up safety and security of police. And so it's been a bit heartbreaking, right, for me to really accept that truth, that there are a lot of problems with law enforcement and that there are a lot of police who are racist and have bad intentions. When you go to school and you grow up in a community and people that you grew up with, your family or friends or peers, become police, they're still a part of that community. And they're still the same person that you know and have loved your whole life. And they sit down at the dinner table with you and they are there for you whenever you need them. And so it felt like it was conflicting for me because I felt like I was betraying the people that love and care for me my entire life.
Yeah.
But now, yeah, it's really hard. So even though I grew up listening to, I'm a huge hip hop fan. Everyone that knows me knows that. But I remember when NWA came out in middle school with Fuck the Police, like NWA was just like this rebellious new music that was infectious. And even though I wasn't really fully understanding their intention of making that song, as I got older and I started to, you know, learn about some of the things that were happening in their communities, it only made sense. They were literally just expressing what they were experiencing every day in Compton. So, you know, even though I had uttered those words before, I had said those words before, like singing along so many times, but standing in, you know, the face of a police officer and chanting that, it felt really, really different. You know, it was really emotional. And even as I'm speaking to you, it makes me feel emotional.
And for Daryl as well, he really wanted to explain that there are police techniques that are in many ways only beneficial to one part of the public. And the definition of what police is really needs to be changed.
I think what I really would like to see is for people to start making it a habit to listen to people of color, to listen to stories, to try and truly understand what it means to be in a situation where you're constantly having to prove that you're worthy to be considered a part of the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
That it's not about these moments of going and corroborating with a major political event or just simply acknowledging that something exists. I think that the real takeaway from this is understanding that there are police techniques that are in play that are only being used for one section of the public, that are only used, like, that the definition of police needs to be changed. And for that, you have to uproot a system. You have to uproot, like, a institution.
Yeah.
You know, just simply keeping things the way they are, trying to preserve, like, a dead system isn't enough, just for the sake of, like, maintaining a false sense of order that doesn't privilege everyone.
I mean, speaking of uprooting an old system, it seems like a totally different age when a popular movement elevated Barack Obama to the presidency on the theme of hope, which at the time was this incredibly galvanizing message that resonated across the country and convinced people that change was coming. Now, it seems that this idea of hope has lost currency with a lot of the younger protest generation. What's going on there?
It's interesting how many artists don't view hope as a good thing anymore, and they view the word as a kind of lazy, inactionable thing. We had someone like Candy who had very strong opinions on how she does not have hope, but she has what she calls patience.
I feel like hope implies some kind of expectation.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really have expectations for what is going to happen, because I don't know what this is going to, like, how long this is going to go on for and what it's going to look like ultimately. And every time I have expectations on how people are going to behave, I am proven wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really have expectations about it. It's more patience of, like, waiting to see what happens.
Right.
I don't really have faith in people to do this long term.
Yeah.
But I do have patience to lie in wait for when they forget, because people will forget like they always do.
I also talked to Marcus Leslie Singleton, who's a painter in New York City, who feels that hope isn't a word that we have time for anymore. We need to do the work right now. Here's Marcus talking about that urgency.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, you definitely don't want to be downtrodden and hopeless and depressed all the time, but I meant that in more of, like, we need to act. You know, it's like we've done enough. I mean, how many more facts do we need about this? We've had centuries and centuries of public speakers and leaders and musicians and artists talking about this topic. And at some point, it's like we've got to unify and act upon it, and, you know, activate some responses. And I think I 100% believe in like doing it, not just saying it, but doing it. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't need to be radical, you know. It doesn't need to be like you're knocking on people's doors and shouting to them about it, but it should be like with whatever practice you have, you could probably find a way to, you know, for example, in like a Langston Hughes poem or in like a Tupac Shakur rap, like and it's an album. I've really been listening to Ice Cube lately, because he's speaking about, I mean, that album came out over, that album came out around 20 years ago, and it's still factual. It's like, you know, so this is kind of the thing I mean about hope is, it's too passive. We've got to, we don't have enough time to hope anymore. I think hope is something you do when you have time. You have time for it, but we don't have time for it anymore. We have a very serious situation in this country, and that's affecting the rest of the world. So we need to act upon it.
In terms of acting upon what's going on these days, we should remember that people that you spoke to are artists, and that typically the way that artists have commented on and reacted to current events has been through their work. Do you think that this kind of moment of social transformation and unrest is going to impact art?
It definitely seems that way for many of the artists that I talk to. Candy, for example, was talking about how all of this has affected her art practice and how she kind of is forced to engage with whiteness through her art in many ways and struggles through that.
It's irritating because, like, I can't not make art about it. Mm-hmm. But I also, in making art about it, a lot of it, like, centers around whiteness and how whiteness is fucking up. And I don't want to highlight whiteness.
Yeah.
In art right now, because I'm just like, I don't want to highlight whiteness in general. Yeah, it's interesting and difficult to navigate talking about right now whenever all I want to do is just, like, tell white people what to do.
Right.
And I do, like, that has had, that's been a thing that I've done with my art for a minute.
Right.
I'll just kind of tell white people what to do and also just kind of, like, be like, you're doing it wrong. And I am filled with that urge because I, like, don't want to say it. Like, I don't want to say it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so it feels like it has to come out somewhere. And it feels like that place is my artwork.
Wow, that is very emotionally charged. Testimony that Candy had. Was there anybody who was taking a potentially more optimistic view of how this is going to impact their art?
Yeah, so Ebony Brown actually had a lot to say about how it's never been clearer to her why she makes art and why she is an artist and how much of her purpose as an artist has to do with teaching people about these issues and trying to help us move along in this fight for equality.
As artists, we have the potential to use our work in different, you know, creative ways to reach people. I'm always searching for, you know, a message or a positive. And for me personally, I'm an emerging artist and you know, I've been still finding my voice, and this moment has really defined that for me. I see I don't have the luxury of being a Black woman who's an artist and not, you know, addressing these through my work. It's my responsibility to confront this injustice and inequality, and I can't remain silent to avoid the discomfort. And for me, my purpose now is really clear.
So this was obviously a very emotional conversation that you had with these artists, and they gave you very deeply felt accounts of what it was like to go and protest. What was it like for you to talk to them?
I cried talking to these artists. I mostly listened. I smiled while reading the moments of grace and their beautiful sentences that they wrote. And from the interviews that I just did with them, it was a real learning experience for me. And I think for the first time in a long time, I had to contend with the sort of smaller ways in which I have benefited from the privilege that I've had in my life.
So clearly, these protests are resonating around the world. We see that street artists have been putting up murals in cities all over the globe. We see that news coverage is fully concentrated in every single international outlet on what is going on in the United States. And it's also resonating throughout the art world, as we've seen. But the art establishment doesn't really seem to know what to do with what's going on. What are the art institutions doing at the moment to engage with this protest movement?
Yeah, so we've seen sort of varied levels of willingness to engage with it. Some institutions like the Met confirmed their solidarity with the Black community. The Park Avenue Armory have also come out in support of the protesters. But then you have someone like the president of the Getty Museum, who posted two very kind of, excuse my language, bullshit posts, did not expressly say anything about supporting the Black community and focused their comments kind of on the wider community of Los Angeles and people of color, which really infuriated a lot of people. And the comments are pretty telling in terms of how the art world is responding to this, especially people of color in the art world. And I think that therein lies the problem. These institutions, many of them are so sort of crystallized in the way that they move about the world and don't really engage with things like this, even if it becomes something of this magnitude.
Journalism is incredibly important. It's also a very fraught kind of position to hold. How do you feel as an art journalist who is approaching these very volatile and very sensitive issues right now?
I think we are very privileged to work in the art industry and be able to cover the making of artworks and the stories of artists. At the same time, it is a predominantly white industry. And as a woman of color, I'm also very aware of that. That's why I kind of wanted to create an opportunity for people on the ground at the protests to just tell their own stories. I really did not want to editorialize it. I just wanted to collect what people were seeing and thinking and feeling. A lot of people do not have the platform that we are so privileged to have, but certainly other voices definitely don't have that privilege. Other voices are muted every single day. And several of the artists actually question me about that. They say, what are the meaning of these stories after we tell them? What do we do with these stories? Should we have a follow-up conversation? Do we as an institution need to provide resources for our readers to continue to learn about what they are struggling with?
One thing that journalists have historically had to do, and it's a great privilege to do, is to learn in public. And it seems that in this time of real social need and this kind of national emergency, the need for learning in public has never been greater. And so there is absolutely a great demand for introspection. And I think that journalistic outlets like ArtNet are going to need to look very carefully at what they're doing and really think through how they are reflecting the audience that they're addressing. So I feel like this is going to be a conversation that is only, you know, it hasn't even started yet. Those artists are absolutely right that we're going to have to follow up this first story with other stories and other stories. I mean, did they direct you towards any particular areas where you should look?
You know, they didn't direct me to any particular areas. But I think what they just want to see from every kind of institution of journalism, whether it's art related or not, is a willingness to keep these issues top of mind as we shape our general coverage. It's not enough to just have their voices represented when we're in the middle of a crisis moment like this. You know, things don't feel natural. And I think that that's the point for a lot of them. We need to kind of rip down a system in order to build a new one.
Well, that is a great place to end it and a lot to think about. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Noor. I think we're going to obviously be covering this a lot over the coming, you know, months and ongoing. That's it for this week's episode of The Art Angle. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. The Art Angle is produced by Tim Schneider and Caroline Goldstein and edited by Nick Long. Thanks for listening and see you next week.